one of the big concerns that was raised both by our initial survey that we sent around before this meeting and something that's been raised by the people behind the London Charter. And I think what we're certainly hoping to do within our pilot project, and what I personally think of good practice, is really linking together the kind of, as it were, traditional narrative textual argument where you're really explaining your hypothesis, your reasoning, what you found in the excavation with the modeling, and then linking through that to the jumping off point to jump to a couple of things that have been put out by the London Charter and just say that I can people see the slides? Yes, hopefully.
Yep.
Excellent. That's from Fred. That's always good. The London Charter, just in case people aren't super familiar with it, basically outlined a number of principles for using computer-based visualization methods, and they were originally talking about 3D modeling. And the principles they outlined are all of the big issues that you raised in the discussion in the survey that we sent out before this meeting, which are that we need to be able to ensure the intellectual integrity of the models, so why they're kind of scientific or scientifically grounded and not imagined archaeological evidence, how we can deal with reliability. And then issues about documentation, so kind of metadata issues, and then sustainability and access. But then they kind of say, okay, sort yourselves out in individual communities about how exactly this is going to work. And we think that excavation data is kind of a special case in relation to a lot of this, in part because of what Dominic is saying, that there's so much other documentation related to it. And creating good links between the models and the rest of that documentation is really important. And then connecting this all to the narrative argument is also very important. So in terms of translating things to peer review, so Dominic, so you've said that one of the important things is really keeping everything linked through to the other documentation. And this, I think, raises something that we've been working on and struggling with a little bit within Gabi, and I'd be interested in hearing other people's experience. But it's kind of a question of, two related things. One is if in order to do this at all, you have to release all of your data down to the last detail, which is something I'm not sure everyone on all projects will be comfortable doing, you know, kind of releasing the complete record set into the public. So kind of how far down the open data highway you have to go to provide that complete documentation and that standard of record behind the 3D models. And then the second thing is the question, for me, there's a big question about the burden of metadata and paradata and creating a huge sea of data that we will never find our way out of once we start just releasing everything, without a lot of time and effort going into structuring it. I don't know if anyone would like to comment on that.
Rachel, this is Fred. You know, in a traditional peer-reviewed sense, you took for granted, unless there was evidence to the contrary, that the monograph's statements were in fact true. We dug a 2x2 here. You took that for granted. You didn't go back to the field notes in order to conduct a peer-reviewed analysis of a monograph. So one of the questions I think we need to think about is how does that play out in this particular situation, and what are the pluses and minuses of maintaining the entire data chain? I'm not speaking for or against it, but it is an important issue. Let me make another important point, I think, and that is speaking from the point of view of scholarly societies, the guidance that this effort hopefully will come up with will be very important Obviously, the journals that are being published are moving increasingly in this direction, and there is no clear guidance of any kind as to what this might look like. So the timing of this and the potential implications are very substantial across the publications.
Yeah, so one of the things that I think relates closely to that and is also going on now in terms of publications is this business of publishing data as a separate publication. So you have things like the Journal of Open Archaeological Data, which are specifically geared towards publishing data sets. And then you have things like the new Elsevier Journal on Digital Heritage, which is looking specifically to publish 3D modeling. And then you have some, I would say, traditional journals which are now accepting 3D content as part of their publications. I know Geoarchaeology, for example, is accepting this kind of content. And I think depending on which of these venues you would be publishing in, the obligations for maintaining the data chain might be different or the expectations might be different. And I'm generally interested in what people think in terms of whether the 3D models of the kind that we're talking about here, and I hope you all kind of get a chance to look around the website a little bit, whether these are more data publications or traditional narrative publications, or kind of where you see 3D modeling content fitting into that.
Well, I for one think it's explicitly about narrative. And the idea of just publishing data on its own is a bit of a nightmare because you could spend the rest of your life writing the metadata to make sure someone can find something in your data.
Yeah.
You know, 3D models require a different source of metadata as well. I've been talking to Agisoft about trying to get them to have an archiving function, which will not only put everything in a directory so it can be archived easily, but will actually give you all the processes that you've done and list them. So somebody in the future could come and rerun that model. With improved software. And we delete all the intermediate stuff because it just takes up too much space. But I know that that's unpopular with a lot of people, the idea of deleting anything, but we will overflow with impenetrable data if we're not careful.
Yeah. And for me, that is one of the big issues because I think there is a huge burden involved in creating the level of metadata that we claim that we want. Those of you who are in this room from Gabi, and I know there are many of you, will know what I'm talking about in terms of the sheer scale of data. And you can very easily commit the most horrible of archaeological sins, which is never publishing your excavation, because you get trapped in this world of trying to meet these requirements. So I think it's a fairly delicate balance that we're aiming for here, in that we want to have a good standard of documentation and we want to provide enough metadata, paradata, et cetera, that people can understand what it is we've done and find the things that are important. But we don't want to create so many standards and create so many requirements that people simply don't do it. And I think just to link this closely into peer review, this is, for me, quite important when we talk about creating standards for peer review and talk about how this process would work in peer review, because as reviewers, we will presumably be saying, well, you know, what is your evidence for this reconstruction or for showing these bits of stratigraphy together? And if the requirements that we create as a community for that evidence are that you have to have the metadata that documents your entire processing chain all the way back through the creation of the original photogrammetric models and what parameters you use, I think we can trap ourselves a little bit.
Completely. And we also need to make it very specific why we've done this. Because otherwise we're just going to have millions and millions of so-called models of nothing with no reasoning behind them.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think that we can do, Rachel, and following from Dominic's suggestion, we can begin to encourage and put pressure on the developers of software solutions and other strategies to automatically embed in their files the various metadata. We've already seen that with photography. And so if we put more pressure as people who purchase these things, perhaps some of the metadata process can be increasingly automated. That's at least definitely possible.
Go ahead. I think I've got my video turned off.
Okay. Everyone, this is Ruth Tringham.
I'll turn it on. I was thinking that it's really a question, going back to Dominic's question of why one publishes the 3D models, and I think that this is a really important point that came up in the survey responses, which is, do we consider these models as interpretation, as in other kinds of textual interpretations, or are we considering them as presenting raw data? And this is coming up also in this conversation. And there are difficulties in publishing, for example, just getting away from 3D modeling, there are difficulties in finding venues for publishing your source data in from archaeological excavations. And in the same way, I think some of the 3D models you're discussing are trying to say that they are also source data. And I think we have to consider, are these models actually presenting themselves as source data, like photographs, unannotated photographs, as opposed to annotated and edited photographs, which could get into the realm of interpretation? Or are we considering these models as interpretation? And I think the reconstructions are definitely in that realm. And so then it becomes, to what extent do you have to present how much of the source data for the interpretation do you have to present as public knowledge? Or if this is an interpretation and therefore its sustainability is not going to have the sort of rigorous requirements as the source data, then that becomes a different kind of publication.
I think that this is a very important point. My personal sense is that it will keep us much saner if we simply think of this as not really, substantially changing the sort of epistemological game that we've been playing all along. I mean, in some ways, when 50 years ago, an excavation monograph was being published, and it had section drawings, it had, list of finds or whatever it had. These things, presented, essentially the same epistemological quandaries that we are facing today. So you still had the problem of whether to regard, a photograph, which after all always depicts a section, a surface that has been cleaned and identified arbitrarily, from a certain point of view, as raw data or not, and also Dominic's point that I think that it's still true that what we're dealing in is interpretations of our observations in the field, and the fact that we present them in three-dimensional form or in database form or in any other media is really not a major sort of paradigm shift in terms of their epistemological standards. It's just, to me at least, it's the same story. I mean, you're still presenting a narrative and substantiating it with elements from your observations that you think are relevant, and you just allow for sort of a deeper you know, ability to substantiate these things. To me, the real question is one of operationalization of the problem, because it used to be that you would put together a monograph or an article, and it would have X sections and X, you know, plans and X lists, and you would send it out to people who were very familiar with that kind of a media, and they would come back to you saying, yeah, this may seem to be making sense or not. Here, on the other hand, we have an issue of, well, the media themselves, how, you know, is there a culture out there of people who are able to evaluate these things the way that you have people who are able to evaluate, you know, site lists or context lists or stuff like that. But also, in practical terms, how does it work? You give them access to this whole, you know, body of stuff. How far do they mine into it to peer review it? What does it do to your metadata effort if somebody says, hey, yes, this looks interesting, but I completely disagree with the way the metadata is structured? It used to be that, you know, a peer reviewer could just say, hey, I think that this, you know, you need another section drawing, and you could just plug in another section drawing. If a peer reviewer says, this metadata structure doesn't work, this may mean thousands of hours of work to actually go back to the archive and redo it according to the, you see what I mean? I mean, it's more the actual implications of how this would work in the real world than, you know, the sort of intellectual framework of it, at least in my opinion.
Okay, we're going to pass it to Dominic, and then I saw both Bill and Marcello having comments. But yeah, and I just want to add the comment that based on the survey we had, people, about half of you all who responded said that you did feel you were in the position to review 3D content. So I do feel like we're a little bit on our way to that, but I think there are real practical questions, like Nick raised, about how this works in the real world and what the implications are when your reviewer bounces your the granularity of your referencing or something like that, and something as huge as a 3D modeling project might be. So, Dominic, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to come back to Ruth's point, because we're doing sort of photogrammetric stuff which can be measured, there is a tendency to think that this is therefore always going to be scientific. But in reality, whenever we do a 3D model for photography, it's interpretation, because we've interpreted at which point to make the model. And so we've documented the stratigraphy we see, and that we can measure with our eyes and trowel with our trowels. We're not necessarily measuring what's actually there. And I think we need to be quite careful, because it's a bit like using the Museum of London recording system, the Harris Matrix. If you're not careful, you end up with everything written in stone, and you can never go back and have any dialogue with it. And I'm ferociously keen on having dialogue with the data. So, for instance, I'm doing a lot of work on 3D modeling sections, and the primary purpose for me is to be able to go back and identify other things I didn't see when I was in the field, because in the 3D world, you see texture in a way that you never do in the 2D photograph.
And yes, it's my turn. Okay, yes. So, yeah, following on the same line, I think I just wanted to say a few words from the point of view of someone who's actually trying to use these photo models that we have produced in the field to create a narrative. And this goes back to what Ruth was saying, and Dominic too, is this interpretation of or raw data. I think it's a bit of both, and I'm sure it's going to be clear once Rachel will introduce the example that we worked on for the purpose of this meeting. But There are cases in which the photo model can be used as raw data. I mean, in the sense that It is just an interpretive tool which we are using together with, I don't know, context sheets and, you know, elevations and overlays in reconstructing the sequence. And in that sense, I mean, to me, it's reassuring because it's not a you know, a product that you can that you cannot touch again. So I mean, I guess yeah, we'll be able to see in the you know, with clear cases what I mean. But I just wanted to say this.
Okay. So yeah, we're going to hand the floor to Bill in just a sec, but if everyone can see the link that I've just put up on the whiteboard, if you guys want to go to that link and click on it, and it'll take a minute or two to load because it's one of these crazy Unity models. As Bill is talking, that'll load up, and then we'll hopefully be able to use this example, which is what Marcello and Sam Lash, who's here with us today, and Tyler Johnson, who's one of our grad students at Gabi, have put together and will hopefully give us an idea and a point for further discussion about. It's a sample of the kind of content that we see fitting into a publication and how we might link through from narrative to model to data. So, Bill, go ahead.
Well, after what other people said, my point is kind of facile, except to just reinforce the idea that I think our distinction between narrative and raw data is going to collapse. In fact, it's already probably collapsing. And I think we'd be mistaken to expend too much energy attempting to figure out how that's all going to work, because I think it's going to work in a sort of practical ad hoc way, just as we're seeing the publication of archaeological data, the creation of metadata standards and things like that tend to respond ad hoc to kind of organic critiques within the field, and that we can prescribe all sorts of different ways that we must do things. But at the end of the day, just like all the archaeological data that we've all been using for the last two, 3 decades, we know that it's all of the reality is in its implementation. And it seems to me that the direction of implementation right now is to is just experimentation and employing methods that help reveal the kind of arguments that we want to make.
So I guess my question in response to that is, so if you're asked to peer review a publication that is using 3D modeling content, and some of the things that we've had up on the website might be examples of this, so modeling content that links to a narrative and supports some sort of argument and then links through to the database, are you, you know, to what extent are we willing to say, okay, this is a developing area, things are ad hoc, and we therefore don't maybe, are you saying that we don't really want to have strong standards or strict standards in terms of what reviewers would be critiquing, you know, because it's in the flow, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, whatever, I'm anticipating the future, but for example, I think we're at the point where to use another example that maybe is a little more tangible to my mind right now, is that projects are going to begin to publish their data prior to the publication of their analytical monographs. And I think it's going to be up to the reviewer and up to the, to determine how deeply invested one wants to become in drilling down into a project's data as part of the peer review process. And I think that same thing is going to happen with 3D modeling. Because at some point, you can have deeply flawed metadata, but if the 3D model succeeds within the context of the individual argument, then I think all of these kind of very abstract criticisms of how, you know, metadata, I mean, just like Dublin Core and all these other long discussions have been going on for decades with regard to digital data, I think a lot of this stuff is gonna fall away. I mean, I think archaeology has always been ad hoc field, and it reflects very much the sort of intellectual processes that take place when we're digging a trench, as if there was ever a handbook that would dictate exactly what you do in every circumstance. I mean, I think this is, the best thing that can come out of the current conversation is just that beginning of an iterative process whereby people become familiar with critiquing the relationships as they're established by individual projects. The same way that you learn how to excavate, not through reading lots and lots of books on how to excavate, but by actually going and digging a hole.
Okay, I'm going to hand it back to Dominic, but I just want to say that I think that there's a lot of truth in that, and that certainly our practice at Gabi has, in terms of how we use and read the models, has evolved over the past, you know, five, possibly more than 5 years that we've been doing this now. Dominic, go ahead, and then if people can kind of raise their hands once they have the model loaded up, and we'll then be able to start talking a bit about what we've actually done so far.
I think man after my own heart, I enjoyed that. I think that one of the things we need to be a little careful about is that maybe we're trying to do two things through peer reviewing, one of which is trying to develop best practice, and one of which is trying to do intellectual review. And it's quite possible that the thing we need most of all is best practice when the football field is changing all the time. And it's trying to develop a best practice that moves along with the changing technology. Because when we started doing handheld computers in the 80s, I was very keen to try and develop best practice in using computers in the field. And I tried with English Heritage to say, well, why don't we just give everybody a machine and give everybody the database, and then they will start using it. And you can develop equal practice by providing a resource in terms of a methodology and a structure. And maybe that's something we should be doing at exactly the same time.
And I think that's very much one of the directions we're heading with this project, in that we are, you know, now putting together these publications very much with the intention of including the modeling content in those publications, and hopefully then, you know, having it reviewed by the community, and in a way seeing what happens and where people think the problems are and what needs to be improved and what works well. I think there is an increasingly large group of projects that are using this kind of technology to do their recording, and so it is something we're hopefully going to be seeing more and more of. These points that we're discussing fit well with the sample that we've put together. Bear with me just one moment while I figure out how to share my application. Okay. So hopefully you've either loaded it on your own, or you can see the version that I'm sharing on my screen. So this is part of our pilot publication that we are putting together within this project that I think brings in a lot of these issues that we've been discussing. And basically what you'll see is that on the left-hand side of the screen there's the narrative text, and this is, you know, by no means the final thing that we would write in the publication, but it's, I think, a fairly traditional narrative of the stratigraphic relationships that we understand, or think that we understand, because we're always saying at Gabi that we change our minds about every other day about what's happened. And then next to it is the 3D modeling content that I have to push escape on to allow myself to move. But this will hopefully look reasonably familiar if you've been looking at some of the other content on our website. And again, it's a combination of the photogrammetric models, so kind of fairly low resolution ones. And again, in terms of the actual practicalities of what one would want as a reviewer, or what we want to have be our standard of best practice, or at least effective communication, whether or not people need access to the full resolution models is something that might be worth talking about. And we've then attached to each of these little models the surveyed extents, which are those little polygons that turn purple, and that's what gets you access then to the database, especially if I allow pop-ups. And so this is basically what we're looking at doing, so kind of linking through between a narrative and then the database so that you can basically move from narrative text to the 3D model, which is now going to be loading for me for a moment. And so the idea is that you could go through the text, and as you encounter something like a reference to a specific wall, you would then be able to click through to that in the model and then through to the database. So, I mean, and this is the direction that we see as being a reasonable compromise between the narrative requirements, so wanting to really present an interpretation, present models in support of an interpretation. And it's, I mean, for me, this model that we've put together here is an interpretation in that we've A, selected when to model, because we don't model everything at Gabi. We've selected which models we want to include in the scene. So we're essentially kind of pre-telling you which bits of information we want you to be looking at. So it's the same thing you would do with an illustrated plan. We would be saying, okay, you know, in our illustrated plan, we want you to look at these six different stratigraphic units together. And then we are in the version of the database that we've made available to you through this project. Again, we've limited which stratigraphic units we've released. So it's not the full data set. We've kind of chopped a bit out of it and made it public for the moment. So we've been, and what I think is nice about 3D models, and I think is interesting and puts it kind of between this data publication, this narrative publication, is yes, we've selected that there are a number of bits of stratigraphy that we're looking at together, but you can also go through and turn them on and turn them off. And so I might perhaps call on Marcello to talk through this next bit, because what I want to highlight in terms of our own debate for this particular bit of the pilot publication is this area here that I'm showing you. There are two bits of stratigraphy that we were looking at that having the 3D modeling content available to us helped us really think through what was going on and support the argument we were making. Okay, so our people, what I would suggest then is that everyone tries to open up in a tab in their browser the model that we're looking at. So has that loaded up for most people?
Yeah. But then you won't be able to see what you're pointing at. So, you know, we need to find a way to...
to communicate that. Okay. So the stratigraphic units that we're going to be talking about are... So if people click on the visibility toggles button in the upper left, you'll have a whole list of stratigraphic units. And we're talking about units specifically 1390 and 1415. So those are the two units that we are talking about we're going to talk about in relation to one another. So those are the ones that we would want you to zoom in on or navigate to now. If you toggle them on and off in visibility, that's a really quick way to find where they are in our little scene. So, Marcello, I'm going to call on you now.
Okay. So, well, first of all, I wanted to emphasize the fact that, I mean, what we're looking at is a, let's say, a 3D version of a traditional face plan for what I, you know, consider it to be, because it has been produced by individual models stitched in together. And so each structure, when we were building a narrative and describing the sequence, could be treated as essentially a single context. And in this way, I have to say that while this model that we're looking at right now is an interpretation in the sense that it presents one stage of construction in this corner of the house we're talking about. You know, this has been constructed basically in the same way as you would do if you had just overlays and illustrated plans. And with the added value that at the time of the interpretation, the 3D modeling allowed much more possibilities in you know, revising and reviewing you know, the stratigraphy that was recorded in the field. So I guess in a way this is what I was trying to say when I said that you know, that the 3D models for me are you know, it's hard to classify them as solely as interpretive elements and not as raw data. So, but basically, yeah, if we want to go really quick through the sequence, let me just pull my screen. So what we were trying to identify was the shape and the exact limits of the house in the southeastern corner, which was very difficult to start with because there has been a very substantial remodeling of the whole structure at a later stage. So actually the 3D models came very handy because in both the western wall, which would be 1245, and southern wall, which would be 1390, you can actually see clear traces of what this later intervention did. And I would also like to point out that in the case of 1390, we had to sort of you know, readjust our initial interpretation in the field because what was this wall basically was originally interpreted and recorded as being made of two different structures, which would be 1390 and 1415, if I'm not wrong. But you know, once we started to mount things back together, including, of course, associated floors and other features, it was clear that you know, there were some revisions to be done, and the photo model actually proved crucial. The photo model of 1390 proved crucial to actually see and realize the extent of the activities related to the construction of the basalt pavement, which would be SU 1400. Which is clearly connected to a you know, a formalization of space and access to this part of the house. I don't know. I mean, I'll pass the mic back, and if there are questions, let me.
I mean, at this point, I would say, yeah. So hopefully you're all playing around with the model and are thoroughly distracted by it. But in terms of the practicalities of the setup and the implementation of some of the things we're talking about, does this kind of structure broadly work? And what is not implemented yet, at which point I'll be telling you it's on our list, that you would see as being essential to something like this that's trying to connect text and the kind of just really basic archaeological interpretation and narrative, like Marcello was describing, to the models and to the data? Yeah, go ahead, Dominic.
Models have give us the potential to do something that we cannot do on paper. And it gives us the potential to change the way we record. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to attach our records to the model. So instead of having sort of deposit 400 or 1390, which is just discussed as 1390, we can actually have narrative all over 1390 that's attached to a pixel or a point in the point cloud. So when we model, we then extract points from all over the model to add our narrative to. And so I think that there is tremendous opportunity here to actually change the narrative and go back to the sort of things that you do in the trench. I'm an excavator, so I perpetually want to be in the hole in the ground. And these models they're much more than simply a visualization. And I would like to see effort put into actually using the model, not just to visualize, but as to change the way we anchor the narrative to the data.
So you see, so something that you would suggest would be that rather than just tagging things to the individual stratigraphic units as we've done here, that you would be looking for projects to go below that resolution to be tagging to, you know, individual stones or parts of a feature or calling attention to specific aspects of the model, which for me, like I agree with, but that then requires that we can put the models on the web at a certain resolution. And that's a real practical challenge, as many of you who work with the 3D modeling data know. So if you look at the model we have here, I mean, it's pretty good, but this is a very knockdown version simply because of some of the issues of putting really high resolution models online in terms of what we think is going to be acceptable for readers in terms of how long they would have to wait, for example, for something to load, or how large a data set a journal would want to take. So Ruth, I can see your hand raised if you want to jump in.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a point while we're on the model that I'm on a Mac here.
Sorry.
And I found it difficult to manipulate in terms of moving around and with the I understood the visibility toggles, but I'm kind of with trying to focus on particular units, I get lost in them. I can't find them on the screen. So I don't know whether that's just probably is my lack of experience in dealing with this kind of 3D model, but I mean, once I see how you're doing it, I think it's a really, really interesting way of presenting archaeological data. Mm-hmm. I would say that it's one of those. It's kind of presenting, as Marcello was saying, it's almost presenting the actual data, but in with the added three-dimensional perspective. But I still have to sort of see what's the difference, what does the actual three-dimensionality of it add? So I need to explore that a bit more, as opposed to the two-dimensionality of a photograph.
Mm-hmm. So one of the points you've raised, which I think is an important one, is you said, okay, I'm having, you know, a little bit of trouble navigating around in this. And one of the things that I think I'd like to see happen through this project, and I think needs to happen in general in terms of building a peer review community, is in part us figuring out how to make the user interface and things like how you move around and get to the view of a specific model, a specific stratigraphic unit, so incredibly easy that there isn't a big learning curve to do this. Fred Lind likes to tell me that we've all been spoiled by iPhones and Macintosh and Apple, and we now need to make everything iPhone easy. And so I can tell you, as someone who helped build the models, that the direct links to every stratigraphic unit at the top will take you to a little camera positioned over that unit. And those are also the links from the text. And so that should hopefully help you navigate. But, you know, how much space we need to spend on that kind of instruction for people coming to models from the first time, is something that we need to think about. In terms of, for me, if I'm thinking about criteria on which a model might be reviewed, one of the things might be how easy is it to use and how clear are the instructions for using it. So here we've included the instructions for how you can pause movement so that you don't get dizzy spinning around, and how you can move between orbiting and walking. But there is a certain amount of expectation that people will push buttons and figure out what's going on, and whether or not that's a reasonable expectation is probably worth talking about.
Yeah, if I could get that in again, the other thing that I'm doing, is to try and sort of see the particular unit, and then I wanted to see it in its larger context, and there weren't any instructions on moving between the very detailed view and then a larger, broader view. I would get to that, but it was, I wouldn't know how I got to it.
Mm-hmm. We perhaps need to implement a zoom me out button. I'm sure that Tyler and Matt will be very pleased to hear there's more coding to do.
This is Fred. There's two things. First of all, we should always try and find a 16-year-old to assist us. But more appropriately, one of the things that I'm intrigued by with this is one could imagine, I'm assuming, that at some point you'll have, this is structure 37 recreated at Gavi at point time X. If we can figure out a way to integrate these, imagine turning the visualization off and seeing this directly below it. I think there's some really exciting possibilities to move beyond the visualization of data to the visualization of interpretation, but link them very carefully together. I think that's a very exciting possibility.
Yeah, and I have to say, our project here, we're really quite focused on the presentation of what we see as excavation data. And I think because many of us involved in Gavi, myself perhaps less than some of the others, are fundamentally excavators who are in the field and doing the digging. We are really focusing on the presentation of kind of primary stratigraphic data in support of archaeological interpretations and arguments and narratives. And certainly there's absolutely no reason why you couldn't also integrate reconstructions in. And it's something we have talked about doing. And we've said, for example, in the stratigraphic unit 1400, which is in this model, which is the Via Claudia, and then the threshold at the top of it, we've had a couple of conversations in putting together this sample bit of publication about, for example, which way, because there's evidence for doors at the top of this road on that threshold, you know, which way the doors would go. And so you can imagine, for example, putting in the different reconstructions of how the doors could have worked, and having those options there for people to see, but then how in practical terms we link through from those different reconstructions and what the evidence is for each one to then what we have presented now, which is really representations of the raw stratigraphy and how we divide all of that up is, I think, in practical terms quite challenging. So we're at a little over an hour now, and I was hoping vaguely to keep this to an hour. So I wanted to ask for any final comments and to say that what I'd really like people to do is, so we've introduced this next pilot publication, and we really want you to take this away as a discussion point for some of the more concrete questions. So we've all said, okay, you know, we agree on the principles of that we want to present this as interpretation and to have it link through to the data and to, you know, not treat this just as throwing the data out there, because that's certainly not where we're heading, but really having the 3D models be presented as something that supports a narrative like the small one we've put together here. But the practicalities of how this is done are really, really open right now, and Bill may be absolutely right that this develops in an ad hoc way, in which case this is one of many ad hoc developments. But we'd like to have further feedback on, you know, things we haven't implemented yet that you think would really help make the modeling be convincing as supporting evidence for the narrative that we've put together.
Right.
So any further comments from anyone? Nick, do you want to say anything?
Just to thank everybody, of course, and yeah, I think that there is, you know, there is a lot that still needs to be, you know, clarified at our end, in terms of, you know, well, from all aspects. I've, you know, I think it the sort of broader intellectual points that have been made, for instance, by Dominic or Ruth, are, you know, very extremely important. And also, you know, all the specific implementation issues are, you know, what we want to start making progress on, because, you know, of course, you know, time is ticking.
Yeah, I think we should really emphasize that this is something that we are doing now. So the Gavi project is going to be bringing out their publications in something not unlike the format that we're presenting here today. And we did get a lot of comments from the initial survey about things along the lines of that, you know, we've been working in Unity 3D, so that's the piece of software we're using to present the model you guys have in front of you now. We got a bunch of feedback saying that it would be better if we were doing this in entirely open software, which for me has a whole bunch of other problems involved, including it being, you know, rapidly developing and much harder to work with. And as one of the people who's actually putting together all of the data and models, easy to work with is essential if we want broader adoption throughout the archaeological community. So I think this is a big issue. So yeah, really for us now, this is very much about the implementation and the very near future implementation of how all of these things glue together. So just to say again that we are going to be at the end of October at Marseille, and we're going to again be presenting again this pilot publication and hopefully having a bit of a longer and more free-ranging discussion, because we'll have everyone in person together. So anyone who is going to be at the Digital Heritage Conference in Marseille, you're very welcome to join us. And we are also hoping to have another webinar, probably, I think I said, sorry, I'm going to wait for my dates to come back to me, but we will be having a second webinar to follow on to this. And we hope that many of you will be able to join us at that. So it will probably be over the winter, so maybe in January. And we'll hopefully be able to discuss a bit more specifically about some of the issues of either access and long-term stability of these resources, which is something many people express concern about, or other topics that people come back to us with feedback and say they think are particularly important. So if there aren't any other further comments, I just want to say thank you to everyone who came and listened, and to everyone who either provided feedback in the survey or talked today, and we're looking forward to hearing more things from all of you.
Bye, Rachel.
Thank you very much.